Welcome to the Habit Podcast, conversations with writers about writing. I'm Jonathan Rogers, your host. Ross King is a songwriter originally from Texas who now lives in Nashville. He tours as a singer-songwriter, but he's also written for dozens of other performers. He's carved out a career by writing songs that say things he thinks need to be said, even or especially when nobody else is saying them. Ross King, thank you so much for being on the Habit Podcast.
Thank you for having me. Glad
so
to be
glad you're here. You know, I've heard you talk about, I've heard you describe your career in terms of just writing honest songs, writing the songs that you felt like, you know, saying what you felt like need to be said, and that you kind of just found just enough listeners to keep it going. I want to hear you talk more about that. I mean, did you have big ideas when you started that you're going to have a big audience? Did you always say, hey, I'm doing something that's not really.
I mean, don't we all? Like, I think that, well, I started in the 90s and the Christian music of the 90s was different. And I was all in, you know, I wasn't necessarily a fan of all of it, but what I liked a lot. Like I loved, you know, Stephen Curtis Chapman and kind of all the classics, you know, plus I loved some sort of lesser known stuff, you know, but I was way into it. And I just saw all that as that was the thing, you know, and that was the goal. And indie music wasn't what it is now. And so I don't think I had a reference for, oh, I could be an independent musician and that'll work, you know? And, so I just shot for, oh, I'll be third day or whatever was cool. And I don't pretty early on, I just got a lot of low level rejection, you know, not like you're awful, but just like, no, this isn't what we're doing. You know, like, this, like I would have, brushes with somebody who had influence and I would show them what I was doing, or they would hear about it somehow and want to know what I was doing. And then when they'd get closer and kind of really, you know, dig deep. And I was so interested in what Rich Mullins and those guys were doing. So I thought that was a thing I could do, you know, and I came up around Cayman's Call and they were kind of doing a bunch of, it was a performance, but they were unashamedly saying, you can sit down and have a beverage and enjoy this, or you can stand up and jump up and down, you know? And I just thought, oh, I can do the thing where I just do a songwriter thing and I'll sit on a stool and people will drink a coffee while they listen to what I do. And I just, nobody was interested in that. And to be fair, I don't think I had a pretty abrasive voice just vocally. Like it's still pretty unique, but it was kind of I didn't know what I was doing kind of singing wise, you know? Uh-huh. And all this kind of goes back to, I was always probably more of a songwriter than a performer too. So,
are you familiar with, Seth Godin's idea of the smallest viable audience?
You know, it's funny. I've heard of it and I think it's probably pretty close to the idea of 1,000 true fans. I mean, do you want to say what it is in case they don't
know?
Well,
I mean, for Seth Godin says, hey, instead of trying to, and he's talking about business, but it's equally applicable to writing of various kinds. But his question is, or the idea is, instead of saying, I'm going to be a mass market superstar with this product, figure out what is the smallest audience that you could survive with.
Right. So the thousand true fans thing is exactly this. And I don't know, you know, who said what first, but it was this blog that came out maybe 10 years ago. And it basically said, hey, look, if you're a true fan of something, and it gave a bunch of, you know, theoretical figures, like a true fan would spend $100 a year on what they cared about if they had the chance to, right? So if John Mayer, they love John Mayer and he gives them enough money, enough material with music and t-shirts and concerts and other experiences, they'll spend that. Mm-hmm. And that if you could get 1,000 people to spend $100 a year on you, anywhere in America, $100,000 a year is good, you know?
Yeah.
And so, yes, I remember bumping into that and it is, you know, and I know kind of where you're going. I mean, that at some point I had to sort of realize that I was getting the same people or the same kinds of people over and over again. And that if I could engage them with enough, that'd be, that would be adequate. I think the problem for me was always, I didn't ever know how to give them more than just like a record every couple of years, you know, and they can't spend. And that's where the crowdfunding thing has become so helpful for me, because for Kickstarters, I've never gotten more than 250 givers at any of those, but they average like between 50 and 100 bucks a person, you know? So, so that definitely, you know, that ends up kind of covering that for me. That ends up saying, okay, well, this will cover your album and you can do it debt free.
Yeah.
You know,
well, for the idea of the smallest viable audience, it's a way of thinking, what is it that I need to give to my readers, my listeners? And the idea is, if I identify, you know, and he puts it in terms of numbers. And I think for most writers, I think we have to, you know, most writers aren't going to, I don't mean you think of this financially. I think you have to ask in terms of the work I'm doing as a writer, what's the smallest audience that I would be willing to go to this trouble for? In other words, I don't think you can even, certainly for book, you know, for people who write prose, you know, very few people are going to sell enough books and stories to make a living. But the question is, what's the smallest number of people that I can write for that it would feel like it was worth my
So time? It's a way to narrow down how much of like a salesman you have to be with your art?
No, it's more in terms of the assumption is if I can identify, preferably by name, you know, here are the people who I'm writing for. The assumption is if I create something that their interests and my interests overlap in such a way that this feels like it's worth my effort, right, there's a good chance that there's more people than that who want
right
to read or listen to, you know, what I'm making. And so and again, I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on this. I know people will say things like, you know, if one person is affected by my work, that's enough. But, you know, do you really, can you really mean that? You know?
No, gosh. I mean, not with any sort of economic honesty. I mean, gosh, you have
well,
to.
I'm not even talking about economic honesty. I'm talking about let's put it in terms of the amount of effort it takes to
that make, no, I know. And I don't want to sound like I'm all about that. I mean, I think in my age and with four kids, I tend to think too much about that stuff. But,
and also in terms of the listenership of the habit, most people aren't, you know, I think most people write in some way, but they're not trying to make a living.
Right. No. And so you are saying, gosh, if this only really makes five people happy or makes five people think deeply or makes five people feel deep. Right. I mean, right. Or makes one. That would feel weird to me. I think part of it is that, you know, we create for different reasons at different times, and there's sort of different currencies, you know, that we're thinking about whenever we are creating. And so there'll be times when, and this kind of plays into that same, you know, another one of those kind of platitudes like, well, I just write the best song for myself, and then that's what reaches that happens sometimes, but it isn't, there's no like truth there. There's no universal truth in that, right? I mean, occasionally I write for therapy, self-therapy or for devotion or to express something to my wife or to God or the universe or whatever. And it's completely about that expression. And I don't have a sense of, will it reach people? But I've been at this too long. So somewhere in the middle of that process, I begin to think, well, I wonder if this is worth selling, you know, whatever, right? You always do that. And so, but then there's other times when I'm doing something where I say, I want to make something and see how commercial it can be just to see if I can do it. Like, that's not easy. Like, you know, we can mock commercial art, but it isn't, if it was easy, we would all just, oh, I'll do on, you know, my next free Saturday, I'll just make some commercial art and make, you know, a cool 10,000, right? We would all do that. Why wouldn't we do that if it was easy, right?
Yeah, right.
So I think this plays into like why, you know, why we create at certain times. And so I'm probably getting off of your question, but this does fascinate me because I do write, you know, for me, And then I do write for my audience, and then I do write for CCM, and I do write for like film, TV, sync stuff, which is, mm-hmm. you know, totally about just like catchy hooks and meaninglessness and universality. And all of those things ring my bells in different ways and uh-huh. make me happy in different ways and, yeah. and pay different kinds of bills in my heart and in my life. Right.
Yeah.
Am I getting to the heart of what you're trying to ask?
Yeah. I mean, I know that you are I've heard you say before somewhere, you know, that my works, it's just not for everybody.
Right.
Which is also, by the way, true of everything that's ever been written in the whole world. I mean,
sure. And it's some level
Harry Potter's just, not for everybody.
Exactly. it's probably a defense mechanism a little bit, right? It's my insecurity, but I think it's also me realizing there's a freedom. And I think you get this as a creative, like there's a freedom in realizing, I can't do what Chris Tomlin does. I mean, I went to college with Chris Tomlin, and we were good friends in college. And I realized pretty quickly, oh, this guy does a thing that I cannot do. Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, and if I'm mad about that, you know, and if I'm trying to like change, I mean, a lot of this is, the way we view other people who do what we do, you know, mm-hmm. can be super competitive. It can be, inspiring, but a lot of times I view it as, okay, that person is doing something that's filling like a space in the world and in the kingdom of God and in the church and whatever else that I can't fill,
yeah.
right? That exact space. But am I supposed to be seeing that what they're doing as an inspiration to do it like that, to also help fill that space? Or do I see that as, oh, okay, that's taken care of. I'll go over to the other space and find my space. Yeah. And I think that you're always doing that. You're always looking at different pieces of art and different artists and saying, are they calling me to be, is what I'm seeing and hearing in what they do a calling to be more like them to help fill that thing? I hadn't thought of that thing as something that mattered to go say, right? Or mm-hmm. am I seeing it as, oh, good, that's taken care of, right? They're speaking yeah. to that audience. Now I'm going to yeah. go over here and speak to this audience. And so some yeah. of that's just me working through those things. And realizing too that I didn't want to have to, there was a lot of freedom in not having to like say, I hope everyone likes this. I hope everyone likes this, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
versus starting to see over, I have the benefit of 25 years in this. Okay, I have a certain kind of person that tends to like this, you know, thing I'm doing. So occasionally I'll just lean in hard mm-hmm. and do that for them, right?
Yeah.
And hopefully reach other folks too. But yeah. I am leaning in hard to that person who I've identified as my, you know, as part of that smallest viable audience.
Yeah, yeah. And you're talking about, and this topic comes up every now and then in this podcast, the difference between thinking hierarchically and thinking territorially. I've got a little patch of ground that's my patch of ground to tend. And it doesn't, you know, it's so easy to put things in terms of, you know, looking at somebody who's sold more records, sold more books, whatever, and where do I fit in a hierarchy instead of, you know, this person has a patch of ground they're tending, I've got a patch of ground I'm right. tending, and there's no reason that two farmers can't be inspired by one another without sure. without moving into the other person's farm, you know?
Well, let me ask you, like, how do you work through that? Because I'm curious, because I've never heard that exact phrasing, and I love that, but I'd love to hear, like, how have you processed that?
Well, it's... One way I process it is by saying, you know, whenever I do, on those occasions, these occasions are rarer the older I get because I'm, you know, thankfully maturing a little bit. But when I look at somebody else and think, gosh, I can't do that. I can't do what that person just did. That's so good. I can't do that.
Right.
I'm able to say, but you know what? They can't do what I do. And that helps a little bit.
Right. And, right.
The, yeah. How do I work? I mean, I feel like I work through it the way you just said it. I mean, just mm-hmm. to learn to view everybody as an ally if they are doing good work.
Right.
I mean, so all I've got now are little sayings. As I try to answer your question, I keep coming up with sayings, which is not the same thing as working through it.
No, go ahead though. You got a good saying that it's memorable. I'd love to hear that too. Something I can store away.
Well, I mean, just the idea of allyship has meant a lot to me. And then part of, you know, just getting mixed up with the kind of a rabbit room orbit of people who make stuff, it's really been fun to see, even over the last few years, as people have found their way into little niches of things that they're really good at. It's so fun to sort of cheer them on and see the fact that you are, you know, the fact that Randall Goodgame, for instance, figured out that that his calling, as it turns out, has more to do with speaking to children than to speaking to grownups.
And that was a radical shift, because a lot of us who knew about him and knew him a little from years past thought of him as a very contemplative songwriter writing deep thoughts for smart people, you know? And suddenly he's making, like, you know, kid music, which is not, by the way, that's not like a step down. It's hard.
Oh, yeah.
To do that. And he's just
the way he does it.
Oh, he's fantastic. And I went and actually saw him a few years ago. And I wasn't ready for, like, how like well put together and just sort of seamless and beautiful and multimedia the whole thing was. It was awesome. I was super impressed. But see, so now you're stepping into something that I think, do you ever think about how occasionally when we're doing well in an area like this, it might be that we're doing well because of growth, or it might be we're doing well because of some kind of loophole or technicality in like the whole thing. And so what I mean is this: when I look at someone who does something so well that I could never do it, I don't feel jealousy. I only feel jealousy I only feel envious if they do something that I know I probably could do if I just worked harder. Or if I had the breaks that they had, or whatever, if I knew who they knew. Like, that's when I get, that's the sort of dark part of my heart. Is so I can look at Randall and be like, oh, man, way to go, man. Because I could not do what he does. There's just no way. There's no amount of, like, work or whatever else. It just wouldn't happen for me.
Yeah.
I might look at someone else who's in the similar kind of space I am, but they're just crushing it, and I'm not. Because of maybe a few things that feel tangible enough that I'm realizing, oh man, if I just had this or that, I could get there. You know, they're a 9 and I'm a 7.5 in that area. I bet I could do that. That's when I struggle, you know, and I want to turn that into harder work and, you know, deeper faith and stuff like that. But a lot of times it just turns into something nasty.
Do you go, are you more likely to go to, I haven't been working hard enough at this, or that person is got some breaks I didn't get?
There might be a third way, and it would be something like, I'm just bad at this, you know, and I need to be better. Like, and it has to do with something that probably is deeply insecure about. I could work harder, sure, but I wish I had a little bit more discipline in this area, or a little bit more strength in this area, it's probably tied closer to something about breaks, because it'll feel to me like something that is achievable, but I can't do it. Does that make sense? Like, oh man, if 10 years ago I had moved here instead of 5, or if, you know, I'd been raised in a more musical home, or, you know, whatever it is, you know, you just, you know, it probably feels like the B of what you said, you know, like there's breaks I didn't get. But it's definitely like a combo of all those things where I think, Ross, why didn't you work harder? Or you know, why aren't you working harder? Or, you know, I don't, you know, it's insecurity and mostly lies, right?
Are you better at dealing with that stuff now than you were 10, 20 years ago?
Oh, yeah. I mean, much better. I mean, but the difference is that I think the struggle that I have is that I'm figuring a lot of things out in a real sort of late bloomer way. Like, I've had easily a dozen people say to me about my last couple of songs, oh, you're really like dialing in what you were kind of always trying to do. Like, oh, my artist stuff. You're really dialing in what you were always trying to do. And I'm thinking, now? I mean, really? That, you know, that feels weird to me. Yeah. And so I'm definitely better at handling the thing we talked about, but I had this other complicated feeling of, well, goodness, you know, I want to hear people say their age isn't a factor and God doesn't see that, but I still feel those things, you know, and I still think, well, what if I'm actually figuring this out now, but it's one of those, you know, things that it just doesn't, you know, you see that comeback of that aged star and they're trying to like do a feature with Justin Timberlake or Justin Bieber or something. And you're like, why are they on stage with this kid who's young and they're trying to kind of do this thing that that kid's doing and everybody can see through it. And I think some of those feelings go into my brain. Like I'm way better at believing and understanding what I was meant to do or like what I'm good at. But I struggle probably with, is it too late or is it transparently unbelievable? Like people see through it and go, is really, like, you know, because I mean, you we talked on the email about Golden, and I'm not trying to get into like promoting my song, but it's a very pop song, right? Mm-hmm. More than I've probably been in a long, if ever. And that, you know, I kind of wonder, am I too old for a pop song? Right. That kind of stuff. Right. So those are probably the things I currently deal with more, is just trying to figure out how to factor age into this.
So you ask, am I too old for a pop song? And then what, can you walk me through the process as you answer that question?
Well, the answer is I don't care, because I spent the first, I don't know, at least 15 years of my songwriting career caring about lyrics almost completely only. Exclusively, right? I didn't know that, but that's what I was doing. And so if you go back and listen, you won't hear super compelling melodies on songs I wrote by myself. Okay. And you won't even hear super compelling performances. Like, I just wanted to write lyrics, put them to music, and then put them out there. Mm-hmm. And if somebody else could have done it, and I could have just written and put them out there and given, I would have done that, right? Mm-hmm. I was just trying to write the best lyric and put it out there. And somewhere in the last decade or so, I just started realizing how compelling a good melody is.
Yeah.
And that I would hear songs that the lyrics didn't matter almost, you know, they almost didn't even matter because it was so compelling. Someone would show me some kind of classical sounding piece, like opera or Josh Groban doing Italian. And I'd think, why is that compelling to me? I don't know what he's even saying, right? Why is that? And I started thinking about that a lot. And so for me, it's become a search to be a better melody writer, and then but not to lose the lyrical depth or quirkiness or whatever I'm trying to do. Mm-hmm. And so the answer is I find that mostly in pop. Like right now, pop music is very melodically interesting. Mm-hmm. And it's also super honest. It's more honest than any other music right now, except maybe like the most like deep dive hip hop, but like, you know, honest, like pop is honest. It's talking about anxiety and depression and racial issues, and all this stuff is coming out in pop music. And I just saw that and was like, oh, that's the medium I have to chase right now, because that's where all this is happening. You know, I just have to come from a place of faith on it. But I'm writing pop because that feels like the easiest place to chase good melody, still put in a smart lyric. Is that making sense?
Yeah, sure. I mean, that song, since you brought it up, I mean, it's such a smart song, and I mean, honest too.
Thanks.
I'm interested. I mean, I know you have seen it as part of your calling to be honest in ways that that maybe, you know, radio hits in Christian radio sometimes aren't.
Sometimes.
And, I mean, even that lyric, I try to follow you, but I don't know where you went. I mean, that's
right.
That's, I love that line. Thank I mean, it, I, and I know you're building from Job there.
Yeah.
And you know, the truth is that the poets of the Bible wouldn't do too well on Christian radio.
Oh gosh, no. No, I mean, or even in Christian circles or gatherings or any of that, those guys, they were mostly misfits and hellions, you know, but yeah, I just, okay. So everybody has a thing that they are good at that looks like it's really hard because other people aren't good at it. but it's easy for you.
Yeah.
And so secretly you can look really heroic for doing that thing when it wasn't that hard for you. Okay. So what I'm talking about is we adopted four kids. It just happened to be something that made sense for us. And the more that we got into it, the sort of more comfortable that it got, I won't say easier, but the more comfortable that it got. So people are like, oh wow, what a faith move. And I want to say back, well, I just don't think through details all that well. So, so when I thought about adopting, I just kind of was like, let's go for it. And I didn't think about all the stuff that might be hard about it. And I think some people go to Africa to reach unreached people groups or go be in the Peace Corps, whatever. They do that. And we think it's a heroic thing, but really they maybe just are prone to think that's not that hard. Right. And for me, somewhere along the line, I was a part of a church plant that really raised up an ethic of like vulnerability and authenticity. And I just got good at talking honestly and not because I'm so brave or anything. It just was the way we did it. Right. And there are other things I'm awful at. Right. But that thing isn't hard for me. And I've realized it is hard for people. Like I would notice that I would sing something that felt fairly normal for me to say, and I would get response that was like, whoa, this is so honest. And they'd thank me for being brave. And I would think, I don't want to let you know I didn't feel that brave. It wasn't that scary to me, you know?
Yeah.
But I realized, okay, well, if this is working for people and they need this and it's unique, well, then I need to keep doing it because it's not hard for me. There are times whenever I do something, when I record a song and I think, wait, did I just say that? That might've been, a little much, but for the most part, it's not that difficult for me, whereas other things might be, right? And so, I mean, there are things that like, you know, Andrew Peterson and Andy Gellhorn do with lyrics that are just really impressive that I would have to work really hard to do that thing, right? But this isn't hard for me. I just try to find ways to say the most, you know, not being odd for odd's sake, but I try to say the most, you know, off-putting kind of, you can't unring that bell once I ring it thing that I can, because I feel like that's part of my niche or whatever, right? That's what I think I'm supposed to be doing. And it isn't being done. Like you said, it isn't being done a lot in Christian music. So,
yeah. Well, one thing I'm hearing there is you, I love this idea of you embracing what's not that hard for you, right? I mean, I think we spend so much time thinking, I got to get better at what I'm not good at. And I've got to really, you know, identify my weak points and shore those up.
Right.
But there's a whole lot to be said for saying, this is what I'm really good at, and I'm just going to double down.
Right. And people like Seth Godin, that's their whole thing, is like, what are you already doing that's working? Do more of that, you know? And what's taking you tons of energy and giving you hardly any results? Quit doing that, you know? And I just think, you know, I do want to, and I'm sure you do too, I do want to improve and shore up the things that can be shored up, or the things that kind of have to be shored up. Like occasionally you'll realize, oh man, this matters in my medium and I'm not good at it. I should be at least good at it, or hire someone to do it for me, right? But yeah, you're right. I mean, I one thing I've been doing is we homeschool our kids, and I realized years ago that the curriculum we were using needed a lot of memorization tools. So I started writing memorization stuff for this little co-op that I was in, just putting music to words, right? And I just found that it was easy for me to do it, and it didn't require a lot of energy. And as soon as I did it, the people who needed it bought it and paid me back for my time. And it's like, oh, okay, well, that's how a lot of this should work, right? There should be a lot of this stuff that's, I had this principle that I call flu shots. And it's basically this idea that, you know, and this probably is either a really timely metaphor or a really untimely metaphor. But the idea is that during flu season, your doctor gives a ton of flu shots and it's not hard for him, you know, and he's not passionate about it. And it doesn't give him any kind of thrill, right? And he could teach us to do it. He could teach us to do it, right?
Yeah.
But he's legally sort of, you know, qualified for it. And so during flu season, he makes a lot of money and reaches a lot of people and helps a lot of people by doing a very easy thing that is not sexy or rewarding, right?
Yeah.
And I just think a lot of people, especially creatives, need to find like some flu shots.
Yeah, you know, that's great.
Things that they do that aren't going to give you a charge. They're not going to make you look cool to anybody, but you're uniquely good at it, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, and honestly, Randall turned kind of that on its ear, you know, and was like, oh, I'm not mocking, what I'm saying, like, I think he's good at this thing that he does, and it's easy for him. And he just like leaned in hard and turned it into something really beautiful. Right. And, you know, and of course, you know, Randall, he's like the most joyfully committed guy in the world. Yeah. Right. So he's not at all cynical about it the way I might
be.
You know, I might wink at you and be like, yeah, I'm writing songs about boogers or whatever, you know. He's just smiling all the way through it, you know, and he's got a puppet on his left hand and he's playing the mandolin on his right, you know, he's in, you know. So Randall, this podcast is basically us just praising you.
That's right. Yeah. No, this feels, now I've lost the thread of exactly how this fit in, but it felt relevant. So I'm going to bring it up.
That's my fault.
Yeah, it's all on you. Nobody is mad at you about what you can't do, right? Mm. Nobody's listening to your songs and saying, yeah, that's too bad this guy's not dancing around like Justin Bieber, you know?
Right, right.
They're just glad that you're bringing what you do have. And I think that's such an important thing for people who make stuff to know. People are just glad. And unfortunately, this isn't in other parts of our life, in our house, sometimes people need stuff from us that we don't have to give. And they got no other place to get it.
Right.
But when it comes to what we make in our work, you know, if my electrician doesn't do a good job, I'm not mad at him. I just go get another electrician.
Right.
And
you certainly wouldn't ask him to do your plumbing.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And so and then this might be an answer to your question about how I work through, when I see people who are good at what I do. I have come to understand that all the world needs from me is what I actually can do and what I'm good at. And they're not, nobody's disappointed that I can't dunk a basketball. I'm a little disappointed,
well,
but
sure.
Nobody else is.
And if I found out that you could, and we'd been talking this whole time and you'd not shown me, I'd be angry. No, that makes a lot of sense. And I have wondered if, you know, the fact that we have so much access to people doing stuff through social media and the internet is part of what really exacerbates this, you know, like I can see a person doing something that even maybe isn't even impressive as much as it's, as much as it's monetized, and you think, think, why didn't I think of that? And then you're mad. And then you start to go down a path of all the stuff that maybe, you know, 'cause for me, it's more about, I want to be a responsible provider. You know, we didn't get into all this and we don't have to, but I went through a season of depression and anxiety for about 4 years. And I would come back to, I'm failing. Mm-hmm. I'm not providing, I'm not doing, you know, because I wasn't in a great career place when it started. And then of course, being depressed, I wasn't being a very good husband and father. And so there's just a lot of, when I go back to a cynical kind of money place, mm-hmm. it's never like, I want to get rich. Mm-hmm. It's, am I taking care of these people in a way that they kind of, you know, like I think about when my sons, after I'm gone, say, yeah, dad didn't provide very well, or, you know, that just weird stuff like that. Right. And so for me, it's less about, you know, I want to be good at that so I can like show off. Because honestly, I'm an introvert and I would prefer to just like write songs and have someone else sing them. And, you know, I had a brush with a reality television thing years ago, but I won't get into it, but it was a thing where someone sought me out randomly because of a skill set I had to be on TV. And I fought it so hard because I thought, whoo, I mean, I have a stutter, which is pretty low level, but I stutter. I was like, the camera adds 10 pounds, you know, all that stuff. I don't want to be any part of this. And all that to say, like, I just think, you know, we look around and see things people can do that we can't. And we think, well, if I could have done that, I could probably provide better. Or I'd have a little bit better of a nest egg. You know, because you hear about these friends of a side hustle that's like incredibly lucrative.
Yeah.
And you're like mad that, you know, they're like known for writing this cool thing, but they also, you know, they also run a business that's just killing it. And you're going, why don't I have, you know? And so to me, it's less about jealousy about, you know, I want to do that. It's more that, why am I not the person who's prone to have this multiple kind of personality, you know, where I'm a business guy and I'm artsy and I also know how to do networking and, you know, and I'm handsome, you know, whatever. I think that's my struggle more, is looking around and just seeing those things and thinking, what does this say about my providing versus theirs?
Yeah. Yeah. No, the,
and there I go being honest again, right?
Yeah, no, I have definitely been through all this. I mean, I was never really hoping to, become rich and famous from writing, but I was hoping to make sure my, family didn't starve and that the bank didn't come take my house away.
Right.
And there have been plenty of times where it wasn't at all apparent that I was going to, be able to pay my mortgage.
And I think because our jobs have people who are like rich and famous, mm-hmm. it's not that part necessarily tempts me. It's that I get nervous that people think, and this is how like layered my insecurities are probably, but I get nervous people think that that's all I'm trying for mm-hmm. when I do something that's monetized. I'm like, no, you don't understand. It's a different world for writers, you know, both print and music. We're not, it's the 1% of the 1% that's actually doing pretty well at this. The rest of us are just living month to month and whatever. And I get nervous that it looks like I'm chasing something, you know, and I'm just chasing the mortgage.
I promise I'm not failing to get rich and famous.
right. Exactly.
Can't fire me, I quit.
That's right.
All right. Well, there were about 15 other things I wanted to talk about, but we just had too much fun talking about what we did talk about. And our time is now almost up, but I've got to ask you one more question. And that is, who are the writers who make you want to write?
Yeah. And I want you to answer when we're done too. You probably answer every episode, but I will say that I have two kinds of writers that inspire me they are musical writers and then just like print writers, because I love words.
Yeah.
And so on the print side, I mean, there's some reputable stuff, and then there's just like some trash stuff, you know, like some guilty pleasure stuff. Like on the reputable side, I mean, I love like Leif Anger, and mm-hmm. I love, I was really impacted as a kid by stuff like Mark Twain, and mm-hmm. I still go back, or like A.A. Milne. Like I still read Winnie the Pooh a lot. Mm-hmm. I just like it. You know, and it's really funny and it's kind of too smart for what it's doing, which I mm-hmm. think is really fun. But I legit read A.A. Milne. Like we as a family will have like read alouds and the kids still, they like it even though they're older. And so I love that. And then on kind of like the less impressive side, like my dad was a voracious reader, but he read mostly like detective novels and spy mm-hmm. novels. And so I got way into stuff like there's an author named Robert B. Parker who died a few years ago, who wrote these Spencer novels. And they're kind of the, you know, if Mickey Spillane is the godfather, this would be like the next generation of that. But it's heavy dialogue, very funny. These two kind of guys that are kind of bros or whatever that are just working through things. And it's just so well written that when I go back and read them, I've read all of them like a dozen times, you know, and uh-huh. the dialogue makes me laugh out loud and you know, that. But then on the music side, I'm mostly inspired by stuff like a lot of pop writers that are saying honest things. It just impresses me. These people who aren't Jesus followers, they're in their 20s, a lot of them, and they're saying these super honest things. There's a writer named Julia Michaels, who I love a lot, who has a filthy mouth, but just says super, super honest things. There's a kid named Alec Benjamin, who's just telling stories and kind of bringing back stories. You know, uh-huh. he's kind of bringing back the songwriter. There's uh-huh. kind of John Bellion, who's a real kind of an innovator. And so I'm doing a lot of listening to younger people and to pop uh-huh. because... And then, you know, and then of course I'm going to tell you, I'm deeply influenced by Tom Petty and James Taylor and Billy Joel, you know, classics. Yeah. And in my field, I'm, you know, going to be super impressed with Andy Gullhorn and Andrew Peterson and that, you know, so it's just like there's a wide variety of stuff, mm-hmm. but all those people make me want to be better, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Great.
And I do love how reading print changes the way I write music. Like that's a cool
Well, I have to say, going to a concert by, you know, sort of a singer-songwriter concert, really, I think that even more than any one, you know, book writer that I read makes me want to go home immediately and go write something.
Right. Oh, all right.
Something about the cross-pollination of the different arts that makes, you know, is even more effective in many cases in making me want to go.
Have you ever, can you remember a time when you did that, when you literally did that? Did you come off of a concert ever and like then have a short?
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's often just a blog post. I'm not saying I go home and write a novel, but
no, I know.
But you know, the thing that the every other Tuesday night concert thing that the Rabbit Room was doing.
Right.
Now I can't remember what it's called. The local show.
Yes.
The local shows always make me want to go write something.
Well, and those are great because they're like the greatest hits of the greatest hits of that artist, right? It's like they get two songs and they're going to play you their very best thing. And so you feel just super inspired.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's cool.
And you're asking, you're wanting to know from me, the answer I always give to this is Charles Portis, you know, the guy who wrote True Grit.
Oh, wow.
And,
yeah.
Dog of the South. He really makes me want to go sit down and write because I like the kind of thing he does is the kind of thing I want to do, but he's just a little, he's better at it, but he's not, it's not Faulkner, you know, it's very much in the wheelhouse of the kind of thing that I would like to do. So,
and one thing I love about that, sorry, just real quick, is that for what you get to do, there didn't used to be a way for someone to put out like two paragraphs of that.
Yeah.
And I love that in our world now, you can put out two paragraphs of that.
Yeah, that's right. That's a great point.
Like we couldn't do that before. Like you weren't going to bump in. You wouldn't in like a book of maybe short writings or something. But now you, a guy like you, or even a guy like me, we can do something and say, here's just, you know, I had a friend that yesterday posted about the hurricane coming through Texas. And he was relating to how Hurricane Alicia, when he's a kid, came through and scared him really bad and whatever. And he just wrote this thing, and he's a musician friend of mine, but it was two paragraphs on Instagram of all places.
Yeah.
And I just wrote, and this is like if Garrison Keillor and William Faulkner like got together, you know, and like wrote a play about a storm they were, you know, it's really cool what you just did. And I just love that's available now. Like these little bites of genius, you know.
Yeah.
Because you wouldn't have had that in the early, you know, in any time until now.
Yeah. Well, Ross King, I have so much enjoyed talking to you, and I'm so grateful that you're putting things out in the world that nobody else can do. Just you
thank
can
you.
Do them. And so thank you, and I hope we can talk again soon.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Really appreciate it.
The Rabbit Room has partnered with Lipscomb University to make this podcast possible. Lipscomb has graciously given us access to their recording studio in the Center for Entertainment and Arts building. We're so grateful for their sponsorship, their encouragement, and the good work they do in Nashville. Special shout out as well to Jess Ray for letting us use her song Too Good as part of this podcast. Visit jessraymusic.com to hear more of her beautiful songs.
The Habit membership is a library of resources for writers by me, Jonathan Rogers. More importantly, The Habit is a hub of community where like-minded writers gather to discuss their work and give each other a little more courage. Find out more at thehabit.co.
This podcast was produced by The Rabbit Room, where art nourishes community and community nourishes art. All our podcasts are made possible by the generous support of our members. To learn more about us, visit rabbitroom.com. And to become a member, rabbitroom.com/donate.